This episode of A Cast of Kings is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way to create a beautiful website, blog, or online store for you and your ideas. Squarespace features an elegant interface, beautiful templates, and an incredible 24/7 customer support. Try Squarespace at squarespace.com and enter offer code CASTOFKINGS at checkout to get 10% off. That's squarespace.com with offer code CASTOFKINGS to get 10% off. Squarespace, build it beautiful. Hello, everyone, and welcome to A Cast of Kings, an unofficial podcast about the HBO original series Game of Thrones. I'm David Chen, and I've never read any of the books in George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
I'm Joanna Robinson, and I've read every book in George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
And welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. If you're just tuning in for the first time, what we do here is we will spoil everything through this week's episode of Game of Thrones. That's Season 5, Episode 2, The House of Black and White. We will not spoil anything from future week's episodes, however, and that includes anything shown on the next time on preview of Game of Thrones. You can find more of our episodes at gameofthronespodcast.com. Email us and find us on Facebook and Twitter. You can email us at acastofkings@gmail.com and find us on Facebook and Twitter at acastofkings. So I think that about does it. Joanna Robinson, we got to get into this episode. But before we do that, let's read an email. This email comes in from Mary in ATX. Any idea what ATX is?
Austin, Texas.
Austin, Texas. I knew that. Mary from ATX writes in, hey, Dave and Joanna Robinson from Vanity Fair. There was some discussion last week about how Varys could be backing Dany now after having played a role in Robert's regime, sending the wine merchant to poison her based on Jorah's reports. It seems to me that Varys is duplicitous enough to want to save Viserys and Dany while still supporting Robert, at least at first. Robert, while a bad king, had good hands to guide him in Jon Arryn and Ned. Varys could afford to wait and see how the Targaryen siblings would turn out so long as that was the case. Once Robert died and Joffrey was on the throne, combined with the knowledge that Dany had dragons and a true Targaryen power had returned to the world, I think that is when he decided to go full Targaryen. Saving the only good Lannister and Tyrion and noping the hell out of King's Landing once he heard the bells tolling for Tywin's death was the final nail in the coffin, if you will. At least, that's how it makes sense in my head right now after two margaritas anyway. End quote. So Mary's was one of several emails trying to explain Viserys' remarks last week about a Targaryen restoration, given the fact that apparently he had tried to kill Daenerys Targaryen in Season 1.
Right.
Or at least was partially responsible for the assassin being sent to kill Daenerys Targaryen.
Right.
So how plausible did you find Mary's explanation?
I think that's possible, Varys playing both hands against the other. It's just the problem being that we saw Varys in the show context. We saw Varys talking to Illyrio in Season 1 about Dany. I think a lot of people think that maybe Varys was backing her brother. And so in killing Dany, he would inspire Khal Drogo and all the Dothraki to take up arms and support Viserys' claim to the throne, that like Dany would be a martyr for Viserys' claims. But if that's true, then Varys is a very bad judge of character, because really, you're going to back Viserys, that little shit?
Like, right, especially with the whole sort of crux of his argument now is that he's backing someone of good character.
Right. And like, and what he says in the show anyway, in the speech to Tyrion, he says, you know, the Targaryen restoration is a group of people who saw Robert Baratheon for the disaster that he was. You know, so it's not that like it's Joffrey that's the problem. Like they thought Robert Baratheon was a problem.
Right.
And I will say this as carefully as I possibly can. There's some book stuff that I think the show is not doing that makes this maybe a little clearer, but I can't talk about it. So,
And
I'm not sure the show is ever going to do it. So this might just be one of those things that they kind of fudge over a little bit, and we'll just have to deal with it.
Right. It was an offhand remark that we talked about at length that I don't know that anyone intended for us to analyze it that much.
Right. But a lot of people had thoughts about it.
Right.
So thank you guys for writing in. Yeah.
And you're listening to a Game of Thrones podcast, each episode of which is typically longer than the actual episode that it is recapping.
Right.
So people tune in for that kind of thing. Speaking of tuning in, by the way, I do want to mention that next week's episode of A Cast of Kings is likely going to be delayed by several days. So do not freak out. I know people, they'll start inundating us with requests of like, where's Cast of Kings? Where's Cast of Kings? All the tweets are going to come in. Guys, we, you know, recording this show is a priority for us every week. But that being said, there is this one week where I will actually be traveling in Boston. I'll be at the Independent Film Festival of Boston on April 26th to screen my film that I directed. And so we'll not be able to record at the normal time. So just sit tight. Cast of Kings will come back. And if you're in Boston and you want to come see the film, join us at iffboston.org on April 26th. So anyway, into this week's episode, John Robinson. Again, this is Season 5, Episode 2, The House of Black and White. This episode was written again by Benioff and Weiss and directed by Michael Silva. So last week and this week both have the same kind of creative team.
Right.
I do wonder if they kind of conceived of these episodes like as sort of a dual set of episodes that they just did all at once.
That would kind of make sense because we didn't even see Arya last week, you know, so like to think of them as almost a two-parter.
Yeah, and logistically it would make a lot of sense for them.
Well, they do that usually, I think, on Game of Thrones where a director will do three episodes, not always back-to-back, but like a director usually does two or three episodes per season.
Yep.
And I know I'll be interested to see because I've heard some actually kind of negative response about these first two episodes. Just people think it's kind of getting a slow start to the season. And I know some other writers that we like Brian Cogman, like his first episode isn't until the fifth episode. So, you know, I'll be interested to see how the tone changes later in the season with some of these other writers that, you know, also have a hand in shaping Game of Thrones.
Yeah. So this episode begins with Arya, who is one of the people who we didn't see from last week's episode. Actually, should we mention the opening credits? I don't think there was anything remarkable there. We saw Braavos, right, in this week's opening credits. But
not Dorne.
Not Dorne, even though that is featured in this week's episode.
And I did have more than one person write in to say they were disappointed to still see the Harpy in Meereen, because they were expecting, since the Harpy was brought down on the show, that it would no longer be on the little model in the opening credits.
I know. It is like the opening, you know, credits is not doesn't update in real time.
No, let's put it that way. It does not.
Very upsetting. Very upsetting. Although we did see Winterfell kind of update in real time after it was burned to the ground. So if I had to bet money, I would say we're not going to see the Harpy there for the rest of the season. But that's
maybe
just putting a wager. Or maybe they put another Harpy up there. Who knows? Maybe the show has a reason for doing it that way. Anyway.
Well, there are still Harpy. Like when we'll get to this at the end, but in the final season, in the final big scene in Meereen, you know, the big crowd scene, there are two harpies still up. Like, not the main harpy, but it's not like she tore down every single harpy.
It was a sub harpy. You know, maybe that's the one that's actually represented in the opening credits. You guys think of that? I didn't think so. Anyway, so this episode begins in Braavos, and let's just talk through this entire plot line. We see Arya. We didn't see her last episode. She heads into Braavos. Sailing under the Titan, which I always just feel like, man, like that must be quite a view when you sail into that thing.
Yeah.
She visits the House of Black and White. Amazing production design here. Like, I love the whole, it looks like it's kind of in the middle of the water.
Yeah.
And by the way, it looks like they filmed this like in Italy where there's canals everywhere. Just the look of the show, the, like I said, the design, the production value, it just looks really high, very classy. Very well done.
I believe this is Croatia, I think.
Yeah, well,
but, yeah.
Wherever they have canals everywhere.
Or Dubrovnik, right? Is that in Croatia? Yeah.
So, it's really impressive. And I thought, like, throughout this episode, like, great use of practical and CG effects. So, they get to Braavos. She's gone on this amazingly long journey, gets to the mysterious gatekeeper there, and the guy just says, there is no Jaqen H'ghar here. Now, she also says, Vala Morghulis, and then the guy responds, Vala Dohaeris. Or I think it's vice versa, actually, right? When she shows the coin. Vala Morghulis means, again, all men must die, correct?
Yeah.
And what is Vala Dohaeris, the response to that?
All men must serve.
Ah, okay. Had forgotten that one. So, they lock her out. And she just kind of chills out there for what seems like a few nights.
Yeah.
Reciting her list of names of people that she's going to kill. That right. list is John Robinson. What?
Well, so it's much shorter significantly than it used to be. This is a Reader's Digest version of Arya's list. The last time we heard her say it, she was at the fireside with the Hound. And the whole old list was Joffrey, Cersei, Walder Frey, Meryn Trant, Tywin Lannister, the Red Woman, Beric Dondarrion, Thoris of Myr, Illyn Payne, the Mountain, and the Hound. And I really liked it that it was so long. This episode, obviously some people have died. But this episode, it's Cersei, Walder Frey, the Mountain, Meryn Trant.
Let me just pause here for a minute and say, guys, this is the kind of in-depth research that you tune into a casting for. Freaking Joanna Robinson from Vanity Fair kicking ass. That's all I wanted to say. So yes, the new list is much shorter, much abridged, but it's not just only people that died are excluded, right?
Right. So like the fact that Joffrey isn't on there is fine. We don't know how she heard about Tywin dying because she was on a boat the entire time. But let's presume that as soon as she stepped off the boat into Braavos, someone told her that Tywin Lannister was dead.
That's fine.
So he's off the list. But the Red Woman, Beric Dondarrion, Thoris of Myr, and Illyn Payne. So the Red Woman is Melisandre. So Melisandre, Beric Dondarrion, Thoris of Myr are all on there because they took Gendry away from her, basically. Mm. That's how they landed on her list.
I literally don't even remember Beric Dondarrion and Thoris of Myr, actually, at this point.
It was like the guy with the flaming sword, the guy who could bring people back from the dead.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. So they were all on the list.
And then Illyn Payne. I'm sorry.
Illyn Payne is the guy who beheaded Ned Stark.
Ah.
And that character has been written off the show because actually that actor has, I believe, terminal cancer, or at least very, very seriously ill. So I don't know if that's why they took Illyn Payne off her list.
That's bizarre because they have no qualms about replacing characters between seasons.
Yeah, I don't know if it's like out of respect for him, but I have no idea what's going on there.
Interesting.
You know, and the Hound is obviously, you know, when last we saw him.
Yeah.
So it's just Cersei, Walder Frey, who orchestrated the Red Wedding, the Mountain, and
Meryn Trant.
And Meryn Trant is the one who presumably, last time we saw Cereo Forel, Arya's fencing master, he was battling Meryn Trant. We haven't seen Cereo Forel since, so.
Firstly, Meryn Trant, awesome villain name.
Like, yeah.
That does not sound like a good man when you say the name Meryn Trant. What did the Mountain do to piss off Arya again?
Well, he was at Harrenhal, so, you know, I think he was responsible for killing like Lami, like her little friends, like some of her little friends.
Yeah, that
you know?
Makes sense. That sounds familiar. Yeah.
But what was I going to say about Meryn Trant? Oh, Meryn Trant is a character that we've actually seen in the background a lot. He's just not, he doesn't have a lot of lines, but like he was there when Joffrey showed Sansa like her Ned's head on a pike. Like he was the guard who was there for that. I think he like ripped Sansa's dress in the throne room that one time.
Uh-huh. Oh,
and we actually saw him this season already, like escorting Cersei up to the Sept. You know, so he's just around. He's a General Lannister like henchman, basically.
Awesome.
So yeah.
Awesome. So what do you make of the exclusion of these people then? Like,
I don't know. Like, what do you like the whole season in general is condensing the books, but this is one condensing thing that I disagree with, because didn't you kind of love that Arya's list was so long?
It was awesome that the list was so long, but I will submit to you this. I co-host a Game of Thrones podcast, and even though I'm the lesser informed of those people, I had forgotten about what half of those people had done to Arya. and even, like, literally could not point those people out in a crowd.
But isn't the point that Arya remembers, even after you forget?
It's true. Although, the flip side of that is that, you know, our enjoyment of that is limited by perhaps how much we remember of what's actually going on.
I guess so.
And maybe the show, like by focusing it on four people, maybe it's more effective than if she has a list of 10 names.
Maybe.
Because you know what I mean? You can isolate and identify each one of those people.
But we're supposed to show the point of that sequence was to show how long she was sitting outside the House of the Black and the White, right? And so if her list were longer, I don't know, and she could cycle through that longer list a couple times. I don't know. Like, I don't
Or
think
again, the flip side, Jenna Robinson, which is that the fact that there's only four people makes it even more obsessive that she's reciting them over and over again.
Maybe. All right.
I will say I loved the sound design of that scene because I think this is very subtle, but from my perception, I didn't have the speakers on full blast, but from my perception, it felt like she was saying the list in like the same environment. You know what I mean? Like, even as it was raining, like, her voice, it sounded like it was in the same space almost. As they progress time. I don't know. Maybe I'm just completely making it up. But I did love how it felt like it was one continuum versus, like, many different time periods when they're showing her. Yeah. So anyway, she's apparently there for a long time. And then let's just get to her thing at the end of the episode where she is in the middle of the streets. And, man, I really thought we were getting some Arya killing action this game, this episode.
She killed a pigeon.
She killed a pigeon, which was CG, we assume, because they don't let you kill pigeons on film sets.
Well, the way the camera, the pigeon went just out of frame, and then her sword hit, and like this
you
thing
see
flew
the head,
up.
Right.
Yeah. So I almost feel like there was a person down there just waiting to like fling the little head up, like at the right moment.
Right. And then these guys want her sword, and. I think that's what they want, right? They're looking for
her sword. They're eyeing her sword, yeah.
Or her pigeon or whatever. Anyway, she's about to kill him, and then the dude comes in and scares him away, and then she follows the dude back, and you find out it's Jaqen H'ghar.
Whoa.
So, I mean, I don't know how much you can tell me, John Robinson, but, I mean, I find this to be fairly incomprehensible. Like, why did the dude make her wait if he was Jaqen H'ghar? Why were people scared of him? All these questions, I don't have the answers to them.
I will say this. You know, I actually don't have all the answers either because it is different in the books. But it's kind of a mindfuck, right?
Yes.
And I would say that even though it's different in the books, the book is still also a mindfuck.
I see.
So it's just a different kind of mindfuck. So I will just say that it's sort of,
it's meant to be a little bit inscrutable,
like a test a bit. I don't know exactly what they're testing her for, but you know, a test of something, her
right.
patience,
obviously.
Her dedication,
obviously.
Something. But yeah, Jaqen H'ghar is one of the faceless men of Braavos. We've seen him change his face before. Did you know that it was going to be him? Like, did you know that that's who it was?
No, I did not.
Were you excited to see him?
Yeah, it was kind of cool. Although it's interesting to me that this character who seemingly was a side character. I mean, if I recall correctly, in season 2, Arya broke this guy out of jail, right?
Right.
And that's how he became indebted to her. So firstly, he has proven himself to be the ultimate badass.
Yes.
He's like the Anton Chigurh of Game of Thrones world. So, you know, firstly, I'm like, well, how did he even end up in jail? Right? That doesn't make any sense if he can shapeshift. And then secondly, it just is odd to me that such a seemingly minor character is, you know, the mother of all badasses and very, very powerful. So I do just think it's just odd. I mean, I like having him back. He's a cool dude. He's a good actor. But just the whole thing is just a bit odd to me.
It's a different character in the book, but like the show often does, they're just replacing a new character with a similar familiar character. So we can be like, Jaqen H'ghar, I have context for that. Those people change their faces. Okay. You know, rather than here's a whole new character that we have to meet. And yeah, that guy, you know, that actor is a proven quantity. We know him. We like him. He's charismatic. Yeah. The Faceless Men have a weird code that's kind of also inscrutable. That's the name of the order, the Faceless Men. They're assassins. They're the best assassins in the world, but they've got a weird religious component to it that is not always easy to understand. So it makes sense that you're like, why was he in prison? Presumably because he felt like he couldn't kill his jailers. But why is that? I don't have a good answer for that. So
interesting. So that's all for Arya Stark this week. We cut to the Riverlands where Podrick and Brienne are in a tavern. This is not much time has passed since last week's episode. And they are kind of just chatting about what's going on. And Podrick, I think, was drawn to the female waitress. Is that what they're called in these places?
Tavern wench.
Tavern wench, exactly. That's a good terminology. So he sees Sansa there. He recognizes her. And it's always exhilarating when these plot lines cross, right? When they intersect. And you realize, oh my gosh, like there's a, like most of the time, these people would have no idea what each other look like, right? But now Podrick has been to the capital, and so he knows what Sansa looks like. So tells Brienne, they have a conversation. Brienne pleads with Sansa to let her protect her.
I want to say really quickly that It's always nice when Pod does something good. I feel, I don't remember if we were talking about this on this episode or in the past. I think a lot of times people think Pod is kind of useless, and I think occasionally he shows himself to be very useful. And so the fact that he spotted Sansa and Littlefinger in the tavern, you know, Bran would have if she had turned around, but she didn't, and Pod's the one who saw them. So, you know, later in this same sequence, he is less useful, but at least in this moment, you know, he proves.
But then remember that he saved Tyrion's life, you know, so he's alternately useful and useless.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, she pleads with Sansa, and Sansa rejects Brienne's
offer of protection.
Offer of protection. Yeah. What do you, like, I guess my question is, how did you read Sansa's rejection? Did you think it was, hey, I actually would like to go with you, but I need to say no because if I say yes, bad things will happen? Or was it like genuinely like, go away?
I thought it was sort of, I really liked Sophie Turner's performance in it because I felt like she was trying, she's really showing that Sansa was trying to get the measure of this woman. Yeah. and thinking about how the last time she saw Bran, she was bending the knee to Joffrey. And I feel like what Sansa decided, and this is just pure speculation because none of this is in the book, is that to go with like the devil she knows, which is Littlefinger.
Right.
And that Littlefinger, for all his awfulness, has shown himself to be a somewhat decent protector of her. You know, and so she decided to stick with him. But poor Brienne to be rejected by two Stark girls in a row, you know?
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty brutal. And I think I agree with you. Like, that definitely was the calculus, at least. And it felt genuine to me. It didn't feel, it didn't feel like, hey,
she wanted to go. Yeah.
It didn't feel like a reluctant decision in any way.
Right.
So then Littlefinger tries to say, like, hey, like, we can't exactly just let you leave unscathed here.
Right.
Because, of course, you can't, no one knows that Littlefinger is with Sansa.
I know. When Brienne said Lady Sansa so loudly in the inn, I was like, keep it under wraps, Brienne. Jesus.
So Brienne needs to, like, kill her way out of there.
Yeah.
And again, actually, Pod is pretty useful in securing like a horse for them. And, you know, Brienne has this badass action scene. Incredible horse riding sequence, actually.
Yeah.
It looked like there were some shots that were like from the perspective of a horse. Like they had a horse mounted camera or something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know what they're actually using, but it looked amazing. It was exhilarating and it obviously showed a lot of skill went into it from a, you know, horse riding, you know, perspective. So it looked great. Anyway, Brienne.
And it's worth remembering that Brienne's sword was like came from Jaime and was melted down from Ned Stark's sword. So it's Valyrian steel. So when she chops through like the horse post, the hitching post,
right,
and then chops through that guy's sword, like Brienne's a badass, but also she's got this crazy powerful sword.
Valyrian steel, exactly. Yeah. And that Valyrian steel is also referenced earlier in that scene, I believe, when Littlefinger points it out, right? About saying kind of how
he's like obviously somebody has bought your loyalty.
Exactly.
Since, pointing to her armor and stuff. Yeah.
Here's the thing though. I mean, when we all know Brienne is a badass, but they did bring up how, hey, you failed to protect Renly and you failed to protect Kat, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, what do you think of that? Do you think that's obviously the Renly thing, no one can, you know, fight against the shadow
monster.
Smoke monster baby.
Yeah.
So that's legit. But then the Kat thing, I mean,
but Brienne wasn't at the Red Wedding.
That's true. That's true. Because Kat had charged her with
Jaime Lannister's care.
But yeah, I mean, you can kind of.
I mean, I know. I feel like Brienne's feeling like a failure right now, right? Because she didn't protect Renly. Kat died. Her one job is to get the Stark girls, and Arya blew her off, and now Sansa's blown her off. So if Brienne's not feeling like a, you know, big damn hero, like, you can kind of sympathize with her being down on herself, but I don't think she deserves to be. I think she's great.
Yeah.
You know?
I agree completely, but yeah, you can understand why people might have.
Yeah, but she bested the Hound.
Yes.
You know?
Yes, she did. Definitively. So anyway, they, you know, they have this really interesting moment where she asks Podrick, like, do you really think Sansa is going to be okay with Littlefinger? And Podrick answers no, right? And I think we all in the audience feel the same way, right?
Yeah, and Brienne knows from Kat that Littlefinger is not to be, you know, Catelyn doesn't trust Littlefinger. So that's where I think Brienne's main distrust of Littlefinger comes from. And she knows that Cat wouldn't want her daughter with Littlefinger.
Right.
So.
Right. Makes complete sense.
Yep.
So there was a short scene in Dorne this week.
Yeah.
Where we got a glimpse of Ilaria Sand. I'm skipping around the episode here, but let's just talk about Dorne briefly. Yeah, Ilaria Sand. We haven't seen her since last season.
Right.
Which, by the way, reminds me to bring – I meant to bring this up last episode, but we also don't know what happened with the Mountain. There is this ominous scene in the finale of last season where the guy's going to revive him, and he's like, he might be a little bit different. So I'm curious what is going to happen with the Mountain.
And in this episode, that same guy, Qyburn, like, asks for a – the dwarf head, the decapitated dwarf head for right. his experiments. So, oh, yeah. Qyburn.
I'm very curious, like, what's going to happen with the Mountain. I'm curious how many episodes it'll take to play that out. Anyway, so these characters' names are Joanna Robinson. Who are they?
So you've got Ilaria Sand, who we know from last season. She's Oberyn's paramour, former paramour. We've got Prince, they call him in the show Doran, but I always call him Dorne in my head. But Prince Doran Martell, which is Oberyn's brother, played by Alexander Siddig of Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Yes!
We've got
Dr. Bashir.
Yeah, Dr. Julian Bashir representing. We've got his son, Tristan Martell, who is engaged to Marcella Baratheon, who is Cersei's daughter, who she's been worried about this whole time. We see them briefly in the garden, like in the distance. And then Arya Hota, who is Prince Doran's guard, who we meet, who's got that amazing axe. So those are the Dorne characters that we met in this episode.
All right. So they have this interaction where Ilaria tries to convince him to take action against Marcella.
Your brother.
You don't have to remind me. He was my brother long before he was anything to you.
What will you do about his death?
I will bury him. I will mourn for him.
And then?
You would have me go to war.
The whole country would have you go to war.
Then we are lucky the whole country does not decide.
The Sand Snakes are with me. They have the love of their people. They will avenge their father while you sit here in your chair doing nothing. Oberyn is dead. This Lannister girl skips about the water gardens, eating our food, breathing our air. How many of your brothers and sisters do they have to kill? Let me have her. Let me send her to Cersei, one finger at a time.
I loved my brother, and you made him very happy. For that, you will always have a place in my heart. We do not mutilate little girls for vengeance. Not here.
He is not having any of it. He doesn't want to jeopardize his kingdom for a revenge plot, especially because, hey, it was kind of lawful what they did to him, right?
Yeah.
What they did to, what's his name?
Oberyn.
Last season.
Like, he did volunteer to be a champion. But the Martells do have a grudge against the Lannisters anyway. So it is interesting, though, that Ilaria, I mean... So what we heard over and over again last season from Oberyn was that in Dorne they don't hurt little girls. And Prince Doran says the same thing. He
right.
says, you know, we don't hurt little girls, not here. You know, and Ilaria's like, I want to send her finger by finger back to Cersei. This is a weird character shift for Ilaria, and I'm not sure I'm fully tracking it. In the show, in the book, it's different characters. And so I think they're using Ilaria as sort of our way into Dorne because we, if Ilaria weren't in the scene, we wouldn't know any of these characters.
Right.
So she's our, you know, our show watcher bridge from last season to this season. So I think that's smart. That's good showmanship, but it is, it doesn't really seem in character with what we know of her. But we can just chalk that up to grief. Like, she saw Oberyn die. She saw him die horribly. We saw her scream her head off when he died. So, I mean, does that track to you, her?
Yeah,
her
it totally, it did not strike me as out of character at all.
Okay.
I thought it was just, you know, she was really upset about Oberyn. He died in the most horrific way possible.
So awful, and she had to watch it. Yeah.
So it all made sense to me. Go ahead.
The thing I do want to say about Alexander Siddig's performance of Prince Doran has gout. He's like confined to that chair.
Yep, yep.
Which they don't say explicitly in the show, but she makes that crack about, like, you just sit there in your chair, which is really shitty if you've got gout and, like, cannot get out of your chair. But it's why he didn't go to – that's why Oberyn went to the Capitol instead of Prince Dran, because he can't leave Dorne, basically. And if you watch that – scene again, which I recommend you do, I think Alexander Siddig is a genius. And in my opinion, you can see that he is a man just sitting there in pain on his face. Maybe I was reading too much into it, but, like, if you decide you want to watch the episode again, look for the gouty pain in Alexander Siddig's eyes, and I believe you will see it there. So,
Fascinating. I you definitely sensed, like, something was a bit wrong, but I would not have picked a gout as the thing that
I know. He's a very trim man. You wouldn't think gout.
Who would have thought that the people of Westeros also need to be concerned about iodine deficiency? I would not have imagined.
There you go.
But yeah, he seems to be trying to keep it all together. And
what did you think of the what did you think of the location of Dorne? Like, the
it looked awesome.
Yeah.
It looked awesome. Yeah.
That's the Alcazar in Spain, which is, like, a real castle in Spain. It's so beautiful, in my opinion.
It looked beautiful. Yeah, it was amazing. So, General Robinson, this guy, Prince Doran Martell, obviously a very wise ruler, obviously someone who prizes wisdom and temperance and patience above all else, right? Let's say this guy wanted to communicate to his subjects how he felt in a really easy way.
How would he do that?
He would need some kind of website. Now, I know in the world of Westeros, they didn't have websites. But assuming they did have modern-day technology, he'd probably want to design something that was incredibly easy to use, very legible, and that would communicate his pacifist policy in no uncertain terms. Right?
Yeah.
He seems like a very practical, pragmatic dude.
That's a website that I would visit. Prince Doran's Guide to Peace.
Exactly. and to build such a website, he'd probably want to use a service like Squarespace. Promo code Cast of Kings.
You nailed it.
Squarespace.com is an amazing service for building a beautiful website easily and quickly. It's simple, it's powerful, it's beautiful. And if you are completely incompetent, like Prince Doran, I mean, this guy, like you said, can't move, probably isn't up with the latest tech trends, but it's okay because Squarespace comes with 24/7 support via live chat and email. For only $8 a month, plus you get a free domain if you buy Squarespace for a year. It's awesome. It's some drag and drop templates for you to make your site easily. It is so easy to use that I think that Prince Doran would probably love to use a service like Squarespace.com, promo code Cast of Kings. Don't you think so, John Robinson?
Oh, yeah, especially with promo code Cast of Kings.
Seriously. I mean, promo code Cast of Kings is definitely better than other promo codes like, I don't know, This American Life. Just throwing that out there. I mean, I think, you know, there's no reason Prince Doran would use promo code This American Life. You know what I mean?
No, Cast of Kings. All about promo code Cast of Kings.
Cast of Kings, maybe. You know, that's a maybe. But definitely not something like, you know, WTF on Mark Maron or something like that. You know? Anyway, squarespace.com, promo code Cast of Kings. Awesome website building service. And check it out at squarespace.com. Again, promo code Cast of Kings. So while Squarespace is an awesome sponsor for us and allows us to do the show, and we hope you will support us by supporting Squarespace, we also had some awesome contributors to Cast of Kings via Kickstarter. And Jonah Robinson, I think you have some Cast of Kings donors to thank, do you not?
I do. I want to thank PatrickSpinagle.com/game-of-thrones is how our like Uber commenter Pat wanted to have his name read.
Also, probably my favorite Cast of Kings listener.
Whoa. Wow.
That's difficult. I know it's tough to say. Well, actually, no. Second favorite. But he's really up there.
We'll get to that other one.
Yes.
Dean Jackson, Brendan Fitzpatrick, Kevin Rocklin, Brad R.R. Buckles, Lisa Goldman, Allison Foss. Yeah?
Foss? Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah.
Foss. Ethan Evan, Mike Palmero, Gareth Brooks. Oh, gosh. Luca Nieto.
Nice.
Mark Racine or yep. Racine, I'm not sure. And then
Racine. Yeah, this
Racine.
This pronunciation guide is no help, Mark.
But what's sad is that these are the same people every year.
Like, I feel for like 4 years, we've mispronounced their names.
I know. And then finally, Joe Kaminsky. Thank you.
Thanks to Casey Carmody, Ian Fay, Peter Baravish, a friend of mine from Massachusetts, Hugo Rios, Stephen Hedrick, Sean Walsh, Corey Proft from BME Podcast and Rabona Podcast, Nathan Welchert, Pete Zoroka, Keith Alejandro, Mark Deaton, Graham Caulfield, and Allison Burt, and Brian Shea. Thank you guys so much for your contributions to the Kickstarter. Wow, that was rough, John Robbins. That was like a gauntlet there.
That was not our finest hour.
Not our finest hour. But thanks so much to Squarespace.com, promo code Cast of Kings, as well as all those people for contributing. You make this podcast possible. All right, back to the podcast, John Robinson. So, I think it's worth mentioning Volantis. Like, they're on the road to Volantis, which apparently leads to the road to Meereen. We just get a brief scene of Varys and Tyrion. Not much going on here, except a nice edit from when Tyrion says, What are people going to do? Just kill all the dwarves in the world? And then you cut straight to Cersei, apparently, you know, realizing that mistakes can be made in the quest to kill all the dwarves, or kill Tyrion, I should say.
Yeah, mistakes are made.
Mistakes can be made. Dwarves can be killed by accident. Go ahead.
Yeah, I really did like Varys' box speech. Like, he talks about how they put themselves in these boxes. Like, people like him and Tyrion will never be leaders. Like, that they would reject themselves if they were picking a leader. I don't know. It was, I think, trying to be sort of a pit and a ladder chaos sort of speech, and it wasn't quite that flashy, but still, Conleth Hill can just sort of sell the hell out of any old speech they give him. So
yeah, but overall, I thought this is just a little bit of treading water, showing us that they're on the journey, and that's about it.
It was a check-in, yeah.
Yeah, check-in, yeah. Let's talk about King's Landing. A lot of stuff going on there this week.
Yeah.
So we have this scene with Jaime and Cersei where Jaime comes in and this box pops open with the Viper and Marcella's necklace on it.
Yeah.
Kind of a threat. So I think it was Pat that wrote in to castofkings@gmail.com. Or actually, it's acastofkings@gmail.com, right?
It's acastofkings@gmail.com.
He wrote in and mentioned, like, so, you know, if you think through this, did Cersei open the box and then put it back together for Jaime? Like, what was going on there? I think that's actually what happened, right?
Otherwise, the other thing, this is a show error, and that's okay because worse things have happened. But so the necklace is a lion pendant, and Cersei says there are only two of this in the world, one for me and one for Marcella. But actually, Joffrey gave Sansa one in season one, and then actually Tyrion gave Roz one in season one.
Oh,
so really,
snap.
These lion pendants are just flying fast and furious.
They're making them like hotcakes.
Yeah. I don't know if they're like cheesy knockoffs of the like classy ones that Cersei and Marcella have, but there are a lot of those lion pendants floating around, actually.
Wow.
So
they really retconned the hell out of that. So
really, really important nitpick that I just had.
Seriously, so consequential. The writers of the show are like cowering in fear and shame.
Kicking themselves.
After they listen to this, which they probably aren't doing. Jaime says, I'm going to go and get Marcella back. He's going on this mission, right? Rescue mission.
Yeah.
Now, remind us again, General Robinson from Vanity Fair, why did it was Tyrion that promised Marcella to Dorne, yes?
Yes.
He was partially behind that. What was the calculation behind that?
It was a two-pronged attack.
Yeah.
First of all, he wanted to piss off Cersei by sending her daughter away.
Yep.
Which and Cersei, since she was sort of pushed into a political marriage, did not want the same thing for her daughter, did not want her daughter separated from her. So she was really, really mad about that. But also it's a political marriage because, you know, the Dornish people are very powerful. And Tyrion was trying to sort of amass as many allies as the Baratheons, the Lannisters could, because, you know, they were in the War of the Five Kings. So there's Stannis and there was Robb and there were all these people coming at them. So he's trying to shore up allies, and Marcella in a political marriage is part of that. So.
All right. Well, that's a good explanation. Good,
Also,
Joan Robinson.
Thanks. Also, FYI, guys, they've recast Marcella just like they did Tommen last year. Not that you would remember Marcella because we have not seen her since season two.
Right.
But the actress is named Amy Richardson.
Since Blackwater, right?
I don't know if it was Blackwater.
Is she the one that that Cersei was going to kill with the Nightshade?
No, that was Tommen.
Oh, okay.
No, it was before Blackwater. They sent her away before Blackwater. But, yeah, Amy Richardson was the name of the original actress, and she was actually really adorable on social media. Like, she watched The Purple Wedding and, like, did a little Vine of herself. She's really cute, and you could tell that she was excited to come back to the show, and then they recast her.
Oh, man.
Just a hot bummer. But, you know, the new girl is also blonde, so.
So I guess it all worked out in the end.
I guess.
That's horrible.
Yeah.
So then what else happened in King's Landing? So we saw that, as we mentioned earlier, that dwarves are being killed with reckless abandon.
Yes.
And they're not necessarily the right ones. So Jaime is going to go on a on a rescue mission. And yeah. He says he's not going to go alone. And so, of course, you know, I was certainly hoping that he would find Bronn.
Oh, good. I think that's what everyone was like. Every response I've heard was like when he said, who said I'm going alone? Everyone had their fingers crossed for Bronn.
Well, so. If you think about it, like, who else would he bring?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, Loras? You know what I mean? Like, who is he going to bring with him other than Bronn? Right? Does it make any sense?
I bet Marjorie is useful in a heist situation.
So he finds Bronn. Bronn is with Lawless, who... I love the casting there, love the dialogue there, because you can just tell Bronn doesn't care at all about anything that's coming out of Lawless's mouth.
Right.
And remind us again, Joan Robinson from Vanity Fair, what was it that, like, how did Bronn end up with Lawless? I think it was Cersei bribed him in season four, right?
Yeah. You know, you'll remember that when Tyrion was trapped in the Eyrie in season one, Bronn stepped up and was his champion when Tyrion demanded trial by combat. So you can assume that when Tyrion demanded trial by combat last season, he expected Bronn to step up for him again. But Bronn was like, nope, your sister has bribed me with a lucrative marriage and a castle and a title. So I'm out. And that's how Oberyn ended up being his champion. So,
But then Lawless points out that the castle is not going to be his, right? Or that nice castle isn't going to be his.
Right. Yeah. He got screwed. As Jaime points out, you should never trust Cersei. And anyway, Jaime shows up saying Lawless is actually going to marry someone else because he wants Bronn. But then he does.
Because he wrote it on a piece of paper, like this declaration saying.
Right. But he does promise Bronn a better castle and a prettier wife. But Lawless thing I love, by the way, because this is just like a really minor book character that it was a nerdy thing they threw to the book readers, I feel like. And it was great.
And it brought her to life very vividly.
Yeah. She was so great. And she was just like, they didn't have to, they've been cutting characters left and right, but the fact that they left Lawless in was just really, really great. So.
Yeah. So here's the thing though, Joan Robinson from Vanity Fair, is that like the question I had is, if Cersei screwed him over, does that mean she was violating their house motto or whatever of a Lannister always pays his debts?
Well, she paid him probably with a shittier castle, a subpar castle.
I see. I
don't know. But also what I loved before Jaime, as Bronn put it, Jaime fucking Lannister, like, interrupted them, I feel like he was about to talk Lawless into, like, killing her sister.
Yes.
He's like, your sister's mean and you're nice.
Right.
So, yeah, it was pretty good.
I also like how when, you know, Jaime shows up, he's just like, well, let's get on with it then. Like, he's just cut straight to the matter at hand. So, I guess they're taking him with him. Jaime's taking Bronn with him. Also love Jaime's, you know, sitting on the beach, very classic pose there. It looks like he's wearing a leather jacket.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God. His, like, we're going on a mission clothes are great.
Yes.
And I love that Lawless is, like, so into Jaime Lannister.
Yes.
She's like, why, hello, Jaime Lannister.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. All right. So a couple of other plots this episode. One is what's going on at the Wall.
Yeah.
So one thing that we talked about last time was about how John defied Stannis. This is a little bit confusing to me. was I was saying how, well, I guess technically the guy was supposed to die anyway. And then we found out, nope, Stannis didn't take it that way. He wanted Mance to be made an example of and to die slowly and suffer. And Jon directly contravened the king's proclamation, which is his law. And I thought Stannis would therefore make it a much bigger bigger deal of it. But instead he's like, nope, if you do what I say, everything's going to be okay.
But he needs Jon. That's why.
So why does he need Jon?
Well, it all comes down to that other lovely little nerdy book detail was that letter from Lyanna Mormont, actually. Not Lyanna Stark. Lyanna Mormont, who's Ser Jorah's, I don't remember, niece, something. She's a 10-year-old leader of a household. And she wrote a letter to Stannis. Stannis is basically trying to draft all the northern lords under to be his new bannermen, right? And she says, we only recognize one king, the King of the North, and his name is Stark.
Tonight, the Night's Watch elects a new Lord Commander. Sir Alistair Thorne is going to win.
Most likely.
Unpleasant man. He thinks you're a traitor. What's your life going to be like here at the Wall with Thorne in command?
Unpleasant, I expect.
Your bravery made him look weak. He'll punish you for it. I don't punish men for bravery. I reward them.
I don't doubt it, Your Grace. But I'm a brother of the Night's Watch. I pledge them my life, my honor, my sword. I don't know what I have left to give you.
You can give me the North.
I can't. Even if I wanted to, I'm a bastard. A Snow.
Kneel before me. Lay your sword at my feet. Pledge me your service and you'll rise again as Jon Stark, Lord of Winterfell.
The Northerners are stubborn. They're basically kind of hicks, I guess. I don't know how to describe it. They're very stubborn and loyal. And they're like, no, the King of the North. Hey, Robb Stark is dead, but they want a Stark as their leader. They don't want Stannis. And so Stannis is like, all right, Jon, here's the deal. I'll make you a Stark, which is what you wanted your whole life. I'll make you a Stark of Winterfell, but you get all these Northern lords on my team. And then I'll have the North, basically.
Right.
So Jon, to him, is a political pawn, but he offers Jon something he wants, which is legitimization, and Jon turns him down. So.
Right. So given that Jon is going to turn him down,
he doesn't know that.
Yeah, okay.
He's like, I'll let this one pass, Johnny boy,
if you do this. And then I guess him being elected as head of Night's Watch was unanticipated for all of them.
Oh, yeah. No one saw that coming.
Right. Yeah. So I do wonder if Stannis is still going to extract his pound of flesh somehow after this.
Well, but the Night's Watch is sort of an entity unto itself.
Right. They are an extra legal entity.
Right. And the position of Lord Commander is not to be messed with, I think. So.
Interesting. But yeah, I did like how they dealt with it. Like they acknowledged that was something they had to deal with.
Yeah.
So what else happens in this at King's Landing? I'm sorry, not King's Landing, at the Wall. There is the election scene. Right. Who is the guy? Slint was his name, right?
Janice Slint was speaking for Alistair Thorne.
Right. And firstly, I like how they called back to that scene from last season when Slint was hiding in like the cupboard with Gilly.
With Gilly, yeah.
Which I don't recall being dealt with in any significant way last season.
No.
Right? So it finally comes up in the most embarrassing way imaginable. During a public election. They have this vote, and each person kind of has someone who like advocates on their behalf. Mm-hmm. And I gotta say, Alistair Thorne gave a pretty freaking good speech about why you wouldn't want to elect Jon Snow.
Yeah.
And so then they have a vote, and it's tied between, I think, Alistair Thorne and Jon Snow.
Right.
And the Maester, I'm sorry, what's his name?
Maester Aemon.
Maester Aemon, right. He cast the tie-breaking vote from what I saw, yes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So did this all play out the same way in the books? And what are your thoughts on how this played out?
No, this was – okay, so this is really interesting. I liked how they did it. I like the efficiency of everything. I thought Kit Harington was really good in that scene. Like his smile of surprise when he won, was yeah, really great.
Very, very tortured overall. Like he didn't want to even be in the running.
Right. And Sam's motivation is kind of clear. As he indicated last episode, Gilly was like, Alistair Thorne hates me. If he's Lord Commander, he's going to make me leave.
Right.
Don't let that happen. And so Sam is like, okay, well, if my buddy Jon Snow is Lord Commander, he's going to let my girlfriend stay here. And then also he thinks Jon Snow would be a good leader. But the thing is, I think this has kind of gone away, especially since Sam did so well in the battle last season. But we've talked before in this podcast about the usefulness of Sam.
Yep.
And how I advocated that Sam is so smart in the books. And so even though, you know, he's, you know, rotund and slow and not a good fighter, he is very, very, you know, heroic in his own way. And this is maybe one of Sam's biggest moments in the books, is the election for Lord Commander, which takes place over a long time in the books. And Sam basically manipulates, like, the two front runners in the race to, like, against each other, plays, like, he calculates this. It's like House of Cards, basically.
Right.
Where Sam is in the Kevin Spacey role and rigs the election for Jon Snow. Instead, they just cut that all down to an okay speech that Sam gave, right? Yeah. A pretty good speech, but not like
pretty
this.
Pretty good.
Pretty good, but not, you know, Frank Underwood worthy. So, what I think that did is sort of make Jon Snow seem more heroic. Like, Jon Snow does seem like a pretty good candidate, actually, when Sam lines it all up. So I think they sort of sacrificed Sam's heroism. Like, he didn't have to rig the election. Jon Snow was a good choice to sort of help with the rehabilitation of Jon Snow's character, which the show has not always done a great job with. Does that make sense? That's my thinking behind it.
Gotcha.
Anyway. Or just efficiency, just to make it one scene rather than something.
Yeah, it did feel pretty abridged.
Yeah,
to me, but I didn't have an issue with it. I mean, I thought that all the sides had good arguments, but I did think, like, if I was putting myself in the shoes of a Night's Watch person,
yeah,
I probably would have gone with Alistair Thorne's argument. I mean, the dude did, you know, like, his loyalties are a little bit questionable.
No, but it was sort of like a, you know, Obama's pastor sort of thing, where it's like, oh, he talked to Mance Rayder in a tent. Lord knows what they talked about in that tent. I mean, that's deep fried bullshit. Like, you can talk about like Jon Snow's fond compassion for the wildlings, but I don't know. As a liberal, I think that's a good thing.
All right. Well, nice callback, by the way, to the freaking, what was it, 2008 election?
I don't know. Were we even alive then?
Who knows? Okay, so what else is going on?
Well, you forgot about the really important scene between Shireen, Gilly, and Sam, okay, and Solis.
Yes.
We can just say really quickly, I liked that scene. I like, yeah, Shireen. I like whenever Shireen teaches someone how to read. And they talked about grayscale, which is the stuff on Shireen's face, which they haven't really talked about a lot in the show. So hopefully that made it a little clearer for people who are just confused as to what was going on with Shireen's face.
The most vivid memory I have of Stannis' wife is that she was, like, really into Mance Rayder burning alive last week.
That's what she loved it.
She loved it, yeah. So
she loved it, yeah.
All right, so shall we get to the final scene or final storyline of
this
episode?
Let's do it. All right,
so in Meereen, we have Daario and Grey Worm hunting out Sons of the Harpy, Daario being really good at tracking. And so they capture one of the Sons of the Harpy. And there is a question of whether or not they want to kill him immediately or give him a fair trial. And Ser Barristan advises that they give him a fair trial. Mosador wants to kill him immediately. Mosador kills him while he is in prison.
Right.
So then Dany is like, well, firstly, even though Dany just said that in order to kill someone, we need to have a fair trial, she's like, well, we're killing Mosador as punishment for killing Sun.
Well, they did kind of have a trial. Like, she was in her throne room.
Yeah.
I mean, I kind of hear what you're saying. I definitely do. But on the other hand, like, there's not going to be, like, 12 angry Marinese men or whatever. Like, you know.
12 angry Marines, I think is what it should be called.
Like, you know, Danny, he confessed.
Yeah, he confessed. That is true.
You know,
there's little doubt of who's guilty there.
All right.
So anyway, she needs to decide whether or not to show him mercy or behead him. And Jonah Robinson from Vanity Fair, I believe you wrote a great piece at vanityfair.com, the site that you write for, about this scene. Yes.
I did.
So do we need to talk about anything leading up to that, or shall we just get right into it?
I don't think so. Yeah. I mean, I think it's worth mentioning that Barristan Selmy brings up Danny's father, the Mad King, Aerys.
Yeah, and apparently, like, Danny didn't even know the truth of the matter.
Yeah, she thought it was propaganda.
Right. Yeah. So that was interesting, that, which kind of also shows a little bit how naive she is at this point, in my opinion. So
Yeah. But that's the only thing. And I will say that if they meant for Mosador, who is, you know, the guy who Dario beheaded in front of a crowd of people, if they meant for that character to make a huge impact on us, like, mission not accomplished, right?
Harsh.
Well, right? That kid was around for...
Three episodes
total, you know, four scenes total. So, you know, it didn't exactly break our hearts. Well, right. You never want to see someone beheaded. Anyway, point being, let's go back to the end of...
Let's just put it this way. There's like 50 people that could have beheaded that Joanna Robinson would have been more upset about.
Well, what if it had been like Grey Worm? It never would have been Grey Worm, but what if it had been Grey Worm? It would have been a whole different scenario.
Yeah.
So let's go back to the end of season 3. You and I had like a pretty healthy debate about this episode Misa, which closed out season 3, which showed Dany freeing the slaves of Yun Kai and then them lifting her up in the air, and then that amazing overhead shot of all these, you know, brown people and this one dot of white in the center. And that kicked up a lot of controversy among Game of Thrones watchers, and I understand why in that context, because I think people have been seeing the Dany storyline as an endorsement of the white savior trope. This Dany is this blonde Caucasian woman who comes in and, you know, enlightens the brown people of Essos and all this sort of stuff like that. But what I would argue is that this, you know, these last couple episodes, especially since she doesn't have her dragons as her like main enforcement, her reign is sort of crumbling, and we're seeing pushback. And especially in this final scene was a direct mirror, I think, of that scene in Misa, where you see the hands stretching out, people calling out Misa, calling out Mercy, and then the crowd turning on her. And so, you know, this is stuff that I wanted to say then that I couldn't because it's a book stuff, but like that Danny's, I don't think the show was ever endorsing Dany as having it all together as a leader, that her approach was the right, that her approach to steamroll everyone in her path with her ideology was the right course necessarily. And I think we're seeing that bear fruit now. Mm.
So my only response to that is I don't know that we've seen enough of her failures to conclude that this show is trying to critique the white savior trope. I think, you know, she's had a couple of rough patches, let's just say, right? namely, people trying to stone her to death this episode. But beyond that, you know,
well, the city is rioting, and nobody is happy with her. The masters aren't happy with her. The slaves have now turned on her. Her dragons have like abandoned her and out of her control.
Right, which this episode, you know, also puts a nice cap on, right? Like,
yeah,
it shows like, oh, hey, this dragon's not going to kill her, but it's not going to submit to her either.
Right.
Right.
And, you know, she's got this small council of trusted advisors, but one of whom betrayed her in this very episode, betrayed her sort of, you know, and she's got the Unsullied, but they're being picked off by the Sons of Harpy, you know, like
that being said, I mean, she's being set up as the hero in terms of, the whole Varys and Tyrion.
Yeah. But what Varys is saying is that she's got a lot of the bona fides without good advice behind her. Even though Barristan Selmy, I think, gave her good advice in this episode. But, like, isn't Varys's whole point, that whole speech he gives in that box is about how we are the brains behind the operation and we need to help the right leader get into the right position. And so that, you know, Dany might be a beautiful and fearsome leader with the right family name, but she needs a guiding hand to help her because her current path is not working out so well.
No, fair enough. I guess I want to see more before I kind of join your side on this one.
But, sure.
Overall, I think you're not wrong, Joanna Robinson. I think you are at least somewhat right and probably fully right, and we'll see what happens.
But I mean, what I do want to say, to be completely fair, is, and you said this before, that the show needs to stand on its own without the book, right? Which yep. it does. So for someone seeing that scene in season three, I can understand how that would be the interpretation.
Well, no. I think that's a different argument. The show standing on its own separate from the book is different than we must take the show as a whole and not individual episodes. Right? I mean, each week we hop on this podcast and we try to assess each episode because we want each episode to work independently. But ultimately, you can't judge the success of an episode unless you've seen the whole thing.
Like, right, or even in this case, a season, you know, because right. that was like two seasons ago, right? So,
right. So I would say, like, you know, if when you tell us to withhold judgment, it's like, hey, wait until you see how this plays out.
Right.
See the totality of what's going on here before right. you make a judgment. So,
and before I say that, I will acknowledge that Game of Thrones has like other race issues.
They have biffed it in other areas.
Yeah. But Arya Hota, which is the character, the Prince Duran character that we met in this episode, is just one instance of, you know, that's a very white dude in the books. And they're like, no, we're going to cast a non-white dude because we acknowledge. I feel like they've heard people be like, your show's so white. And they're like, cool. All right. Well, we'll see what we can do about that. So maybe they aren't doing enough. Probably they're not doing enough. But I think they're trying.
Overall thoughts on this episode, Jenna Robinson?
We've sort of buzzed past it, but that last Drogon shot was pretty incredible effects-wise, I thought. Did you think it looked good, the Drogon shot?
Looked good. Looked good.
Yeah.
Looked good. Looked like it was straight out of Dragonheart. I'm being slightly facetious.
Which is a classic, a Sean Connery classic. overall, I mean, I hear people's critiques and they say it's slow. I won't argue with that. It's gearing up, I think.
All right.
Right?
I think this episode was, it's pretty meh. You know, I thought it's, you know, like more setting the table for stuff that's hopefully going to be more interesting later. But this is certainly not one of my favorite episodes of all time. You know, it's just kind of like, oh, we're advancing these little plots along little by little, and hopefully they'll pay off in a big way at some point this season. So,
but I think that Dragonheart shot is going to go down in as one of the famous.
Dragonheart-esque. So, all right, Jenna Robinson, where can I find more of your work on the internet?
If you want to hear me talk about spoilers, I do a spoilery Game of Thrones cast called Storm of Spoilers. You can follow us on Twitter at Storm of Spoilers. You can find us on iTunes. You can read my writing over on VanityFair.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This.
Wait, where do you write for, Jonah Robinson?
Oh, it's a little site called VanityFair.com.
Okay. You notice how I've said that like 50 times this episode because someone...
Oh, has... not only have I noticed, but I'm sure everyone who's listening has noticed. I've been trying to ignore it.
Here's the thing people don't understand is if you say, hey, Dave, this thing that you do is incredibly annoying, I'm just going to do it tenfold. Like,
you guys, that's why he says my full name every time.
Yeah, I mean, you realize, if people had just not bothered me about it, I probably would have just stopped saying Jonah Robinson. But now... Yeah. I must entrench myself in my position.
Hatred only makes you stronger.
I am like a game of... I'm like Mance Rayder here. You know, when people resist me, it only enforces my own position here.
You're like Obi-Wan Kenobi. Strike you down, you will only become more powerful than they could ever imagine.
That's right. Right? If you're in the New England area, I would urge you to come to the Independent Film Festival of Boston this Sunday, April 26th. To see a screening of my film, The Primary Instinct. Go to iffboston.org to check out tickets for that film. Hope to see you guys there. And you can also find my other podcast that I do at bigproblemspodcast.com. Thanks for listening to A Cast of Kings. We'll see you guys next week.